Teddy said when she came downstairs. Mrs. Crowther told me you had a migraine, so I let you sleep. Nancy wondered if Mrs. Crowther had been given a row from her husband and the old man. I gave her a bit extra for hanging on. I said this morning that you looked peaky. That must have been why. Shall I fry you a chop for your supper? She didn't have another migraine, just a few more headaches than normal. Nothing as startling as that day in the sick room. I expect your job is rather taxing, the optician said, when she visited him to discover why she was occasionally seeing a wave of light in her left eye, a little shimmering line of gold that was actually rather pretty. Optical migraine, he said, peering into her eye, so close to her that she could smell the peppermint he had taken to mask, not very successfully, the oniony smell of his lunch. You don't necessarily experience pain with them, dear. He was quite elderly, the avuncular sort, and had practiced for years in their small local town. There was nothing, he said reassuringly, that he didn't know about eyes. And sometimes, when I've been writing a lot on the blackboard, Nancy said, my eyesight goes a bit blotchy, like Vaseline rubbed on glass, and I can't read or write properly. Definitely an optical migraine, he said. I had a proper migraine recently, she said, and a few more headaches than usual. There you go, then, he said. My mother used to have headaches, she said, recalling her mother dragging herself up the stairs to her darkened bedroom, her sad, uncomplaining smile when she said to them, one of my heads, I'm afraid. That used to make them laugh, not when she was in pain. They were not cruel daughters. The Hydra, they called her affectionately. But a nice one, Milly said. A lovely, darling mummy Hydra. Later, Nancy wondered if she had sensed something, a kind of premonition, that had motivated her to choose that particular evening to suggest uprooting the three of them and moving into town, where life would be easier and more convenient. As she left the optician's, however, armed with a prescription for reading glasses, just the age you've reached, dear, nothing to worry about. The thought uppermost in her mind was the pot of tea and the toasted tea cake that she was going to treat herself to in the cafe around the corner before setting off on the rather arduous cycle home. It was a hot day and Teddy had the car. He was going to an agricultural show, a reluctant viola in tow. She was awfully tired, Nancy thought, but the tea would buck her up. It did, and as she was sorting out her change for a tip for the waitress, she was struck with the thought that the only thing that was happening to her and Teddy, and even Viola, although less urgently, was that they were simply growing older. Otherwise, their lives stayed the same. They were treading water, plodding along in a rut. Why shouldn't they do something different, shake themselves up a little? Plodding, Teddy said, a fleeting spasm of distress taking hold of his features. They were in bed, cocoa and library books and so on. A good definition of plodding in anyone's lexicon, Nancy supposed. She remembered Sylvie saying, marriage blunts one so. It's not an insult, she said, but Teddy didn't look convinced. One weekend, not long after they had made the move to York, Nancy was taking the Sunday roast from the oven when, with no warning at all, her left arm gave way and the pan and its contents clattered to the floor. Teddy must have heard the noise because he came rushing through to the kitchen and said, are you all right? Yes, yes, fine, she said, surveying with dismay the carnage of lamb and potatoes, not to mention the hot fat that had splattered everywhere. Not burnt, Teddy said anxiously. No, she reassured him, not burnt. I'm a clumsy dolt, I really am. I'll fetch a cloth. I suppose that I'm used to the arger in the old house, and I just, I don't know, misjudge something. Oh, the poor lamb, she added sadly, as if the joint was an old friend. Do you think we can salvage it? Scrape it up off the floor and pretend nothing happened? The leg of lamb seemed to have crusted itself in every last bit of grit and dirt on what Nancy had previously thought was a clean kitchen floor. She silently berated herself for her sluttish house-whiffery. Could we wash it under the hot tap? We wouldn't have let it go to waste during the war. We still have carrots, she added hopefully, and mint sauce. Teddy laughed and said, I think I'd better heat up a tin of beans and scramble some eggs. I can't see Viola eating carrots for Sunday lunch. There had been other little things, numbness and tingle in that rogue left arm, more headaches, and another awful migraine that started on a Friday evening and didn't clear until Monday morning. It prompted her into visiting their new GP, hoping for a prescription for strong painkillers. After some rather odd tests, walking in a straight line, moving her head in different directions, as if testing her for drunkenness, the GP said he wanted to refer her to the hospital. He was the youthful partner of an older doctor in the practice, and was eager not to make mistakes. But no need for alarm, he said. You're probably right about it being migraine. No hurry either, apparently. And by the time the appointment card for the specialist came through the letterbox, Nancy thought the hospital must have forgotten about her. She had told Teddy none of this. There seemed no point in worrying him. He was a worrier. Nancy wasn't. She supposed the results would be vague, and she would end up like her mother, having heads. She doubted she could suffer as patiently. It was perfect spring weather on the day of Nancy's hospital appointment, and when she left school at break time, back by lunchtime, she decided to walk to the hospital. If she planned her route, she could walk part of the way on the bar walls and enjoy the daffodils, recently come into flower and now in their golden pomp, a phrase she recalled from an old column of Agrestis. Teddy had been enraptured by the wild daffodils he had encountered unexpectedly on a woodland walk a couple of years ago. Teddy had, so far, kept on his nature notes. It was a short piece once a month, he argued to himself, and he could easily drive out to the countryside. They could all go, take a picnic, a pair of binoculars. It's not quite the same, I know, as being in the middle of it. The middle of nowhere, he added rather pointedly, but needs must, until the recorder can find someone to replace me. They did find someone, a year later. A woman, in fact, although the new Agrestis never admitted to this change in his sex. But by then it was of no consequence to Teddy. Very little was. And he left Agrestis behind, without a backward glance. The daffodils growing on the grass slopes beneath the bar walls were truly lovely. There were none in the garden in the new house for some reason. Surely everyone had daffodils. And Nancy determined that she must talk to Teddy about planting some. Lots of them. A host, in fact, in a great Wordsworthian drift. He would like that. To her surprise, he had taken to gardening, perusing seed catalogues and drawing up plans and sketches. Nancy gave him free rein, although he continued to consult her. How do you feel about gladioli? What about a small pond? Peas or beans, or both? It was when she had come down from the walls at Monkgate Bar and was waiting to cross the road at the traffic lights that a black curtain suddenly descended and covered her left eye, more of a blind than a curtain. She had never thought before about where the word came from. Her own personal blackout. She sensed disaster. Struck blind. It felt biblical, although Monkgate was hardly the road to Damascus. She managed to find a bench nearby and sat quietly, waiting to see what would happen next. A revelation of faith? It seemed unlikely. If she had gone completely blind, she would have called out for help. But the loss of only one eye didn't seem cause enough to involve complete strangers. That's ridiculous, Millie said when she told her. I would have been screeching my head off. But Nancy was not Millie. After 10 minutes or so of sitting on the bench in a kind of quiet contemplation, the blackout blind lifted, as quickly and mysteriously as it had fallen, and the sight in her eye returned. Nerves scrambled or something, she said to the consultant when she eventually arrived at the hospital. I suppose it was jolly good luck I wasn't driving, or cycling for that matter. She found herself chatty with relief. The crisis passed, the biblical disaster averted. Well, the consultant said, Let's get you checked out thoroughly anyway, shall we? He was neither youthful nor maternal, nor avuncular, and had very little to say on the subject of migraines. Oh, and then it all just went on so quickly, like some awful express train that wouldn't stop. They did more tests and x-rays. They were vague with her, unsure about what they were seeing, they said. She was married, wasn't she? Why didn't she bring her husband along to the next appointment? Not if they don't give me a diagnosis, she said to B on the phone. They're being cagey with me for no good reason. She knew what happened with bad cases. They told spouses, siblings, even friends, anyone but the patient, so that they could go on living a normal life. She'd known a Wren at Bletchley Park, Barbara Toms, down-to-earth type, one of the cogs in the wheel, the many wheels. Nancy had been a bigger wheel, a decoder, one of the boys. Normally, she wouldn't have had much to do with a lowly cog, but they had both been county netball players, had tried and failed to get a team going at Bletchley. Nancy had been a half-blue at Cambridge. Nancy had her own table by the end of the war, was deputy head of the hut. She had known them all, Turing, Tony Kendrick, Peter Twin. She had loved that world, occluded, secretive, self-sufficient. But she had always understood that it was temporary, that normal service would be resumed, would have to be resumed. Poor Barbara developed a cancer. Very rapid, incurable. A woman's cancer, too embarrassing for her less down-to-earth mother to go into detail over. Mrs. Toms had told someone Barbara worked with, and pretty soon all the girls in Barbara's section knew. Everyone, except for Barbara. They were sworn to secrecy by Mrs. Toms, because that was what her doctors had advised. "So as not to cast a shadow over what's left of her life," she explained to them. The poor girl kept on working, until she couldn't go on any longer, and then went home, to die, still in ignorance. Still waiting in hope to be cured. She had almost forgotten about Barbara, when Mrs. Toms wrote and said she was dead and buried. A quiet funeral. She never knew what was wrong. That was a comfort. Pah, Nancy thought. If she had some horrible disease that was going to kill her, she didn't want to be kept in the dark. She wanted to know. In fact, she would have it the other way round. She would know, and her nearest and dearest wouldn't. Why should Teddy and Viola live beneath the shadow? "You need to see someone in Harley Street," B said to her. "I've still got a few connections in the medical world." B had been married to a surgeon after the war, but it hadn't lasted. "I don't think I'm cut out for marriage. I'll find out who's best in the field, someone who won't mess you about. But you should tell Teddy, Nancy." "I shall, I promise." She had nearly died when she gave birth to Viola, and had felt somehow that she was proofed against disaster. Perhaps that was why it had taken her so long to chase this thing down. And all the time it was chasing her, and her mind, of all things. If only it could have been a breast, an arm, an eye. Even if it had meant an early death, at least she would have been able to keep her mind to the end. Sometimes, when she found herself mired in the twin duties of marriage and motherhood, she thought how her life had been compromised by love. Viola coming out of the womb on a wave of anger. Teddy always putting on a cheerful front, pretending that he wasn't brooding inside. When they first moved into this house, there had been a lovely lilac that graced the front garden, but Teddy had chopped it down when it was in full scented flower in the first April. "But why?" she said. But then saw the look in his eyes, and realized it was something from the war, the great fall from grace, and he was unlikely to explain it. Teddy's war was the one enigma that she would never decode. But it was the 1960s, for heaven's sake, she sometimes thought, finding herself losing patience. She was tired. She seemed to spend a good deal of her time chivying and encouraging people. Teddy, Viola, her pupils. It was rather like being the captain of the netball team that she had once been. Teddy was not the only one who had sacrificed precious years. She had gained a first in parts 1 and 2 of the Tripos at Newnham. She was a wrangler, graduated with a double first in mathematics in 36, was awarded the Philippa Fawcett Prize, and then had been plucked, recruited to go to the Government Code and Cipher School in the spring of 1940. She had given up a brilliant career for the war, and then given it up again for Teddy and Viola.
"I'm going down to Lyme to give Gertie a hand with her house move."
"All right. That's good of you," Teddy said.
"It's just packing the light stuff, crockery and ornaments and so on. Only a couple of days. I thought it would be nice to spend some time with her, just the two of us."
The day after she returned home, there was a card from Gertie, a watercolour of Viola's on the front of it.
"Our mother's favourite flower, of course, as you know."
No, she had forgotten, and yet she had named her daughter Viola. It had been for Shakespeare, not her mother. How could a daughter forget such a thing, or at any rate not consciously remember? What would her own daughter forget in time? Nancy felt a sudden sense of desolation. She wished her mother was still here. This would be how Viola would feel without a mother. It was unbearable. Hot, painful tears welled up in her eyes. She brushed them away and told herself to pull her socks up. She continued with Gertie's card.
"I just thought I should drop you a quick note," she wrote. "Teddy phoned looking for you while you were here. I hope I fudged enough, made out I was a complete dimwit.
Are you sure, darling, you shouldn't tell him what's happening?
Not interfering, just saying. Much love, G. P.S. Did you come to a decision about the sideboard?"
"You should tell him," Millie said. "You really should. I mean, I covered for you awfully well, saying I'd just put you on the train and everything, and what a wonderful time we had in the lakes. But Teddy's going to find out, one way or another."
It was her sisters, not her husband, that Nancy had turned to. Little flurries of communication between different permutations of them. She could burden her sisters, but she couldn't burden Teddy. He wasn't naive. He probably suspected something. But she wasn't going to tell him until it was definitive. At heart, she would always be a mathematician, her faith in absolutes. And if the worst came to the worst, then the less time he had to suffer knowing, the better.
"You have to tell him, Nancy." "I will, Millie. Of course I will."
She may not have been in Dorset or the Lakes, but Nancy was most certainly in London with B. Not, it was true, taking in a show, maybe an exhibition, but sitting on the sofa in her sister's rather bohemian Chelsea bedsit, nursing a glass of whiskey. Ursula, sitting next to Nancy, had brought a bottle with her.
"I thought we would need something stronger than tea," she said.
"I always have gin," B said.
She had been divorced for some time now from her surgeon husband. She worked at the BBC and was happy being single, she said. Millie arrived in a fluster and out of breath from rushing up the stairs.
"I got lost," she said. "Sorry."
"Whiskey or gin?" B offered. "Or tea?"
"I'm tempted by all three, but gin, please. A stiff one."
She glanced over at Nancy, but continued to address B.
"I need it, don't I? It's bad, isn't it?"
"Very bad," B said, her voice pitchy.
"Completely bad."
Millie was using a funny, clipped accent, either trying not to give way to emotion, or imagining herself to be a character in a play or a film, one who was putting on a stiff upper lip. Celia Johnson in Brief Encounter came to mind. The call of duty, the moral imperative of doing the right thing. Nancy admired it, and yet something in her now rebelled. Run away, she thought, forget duty. She imagined herself fleeing down B's steep, narrow staircase and out into the street, along the river, on and on, until she had outpaced the dread thing on her heels. A glint in Millie's eye, and a little tremor in her hand as she took the glass of gin, reassured Nancy that she wasn't play-acting.
I am here, she said to her. You can ask me. I don't think I want to ask you, Millie said. I don't think I want to know.
The glint turned into a tear that rolled down her cheek, and Bea pushed her gently towards a chair and then sat on the carpet at her feet.
Well, it is true, Nancy said calmly. It's been confirmed, and I'm afraid it is completely bad, as you put it. I'm sorry to say that it's the worst it could possibly be.
Millie let out an awful sob, and her hand flew to her mouth, as if she could stop the sound escaping, but too late. Bea grabbed her other hand, and they clung to each other. They looked as if they were facing shipwreck.
Is there nothing to be done?
Ursula asked.
Surely.
No, Nancy said, cutting her short. They would all want to be hopeful, to see possibilities, and she had moved beyond possibilities.
He said that if perhaps it had been detected at an earlier stage, there might have been something. And he won't operate, she said,
holding up a hand to silence Bea, who was about to protest.
They can't operate because of where it is. And now it's become tangled with blood vessels. Oh, God, Millie said.
She looked green. She was always the most squeamish of all of them.
Which makes it impossible. An operation would at best be the end of me. And if death is the best, what is the worst?
Ursula puzzled. Millie gave a little gasp at the word death, as if uttering it was somehow blasphemous.
I would probably be left almost completely incapacitated, mentally and physically.
Probably, Bea said, still clinging to hope amongst the storm-tossed wreckage.
Almost certainly, Nancy said. Which will be the end of me too, in a different way. But even that would be no good, as, because of its position, they wouldn't be able to cut it all out.
Millie looked as if she was going to retch.
It would carry on growing. Really, Nancy said, perhaps less kindly than she had intended, it would be better for me, if you accept this.
She had divined in her heart that this was coming, ever since that first visit to Harley Street, when she was supposedly helping Gertie to move house. The consultant Bea had found, Dr. Morton Fraser, was a sensible sort of Scot.
Comes highly recommended, Bea had said. Reputation for being scrupulous. No stone unturned, and so on.
There had been perhaps a little hope then, less so when she returned the following month, Wordsworth's cottage and so on, and he showed her the X-rays, and she could see how much it had already grown in a short time.
Perhaps if you had come to me a year ago, he said. But even then, who knows?
Very rapid. Incurable. Poor Barbara Toms's diagnosis.
I can't bear it,
Millie murmured, as Bea went round topping up their glasses. Nancy felt a sudden flash of resentment. She was the one who had to bear it, not them. She wanted to be left alone in peace, to disappear into her own quiet world and meditate upon death.
Death.
Yes, she could form that blunt, obscene word, too. But instead, she was the one who was going to have to be kind and strong and say that everything was going to be all right, which it clearly was not, and that she had come to terms with it.
It's going to be all right, she said to Millie. I'm all right. I've come to terms with it, and now you must. And Teddy,
Ursula said, her voice breaking.
He phoned me this morning, Nancy. He suspects you of having an affair, for heaven's sake. You must put him out of his misery.
Nancy laughed bitterly and said,
And put him in a worse misery. Tell him as soon as possible. It's unfair keeping him in the dark this long.
Ursula, Nancy thought rather irritably, always Teddy's greatest champion and protector.
Although, I suppose not Viola. Oh, God,
Viola, Nancy thought. She was quietly convulsed with despair.
No, not Viola, B said quickly. She's far too young to understand.
We'll be there for her, Millie said wildly. We'll care for her. But first you have to tell Teddy,
Ursula said insistently.
You have to go home now and tell him.
Yes,
Nancy sighed.
Yes, I will.
They all accompanied her to King's Cross and saw her on the train. B kissed her tenderly, as if she had suddenly turned to thinnest glass and might shatter at any moment.
Courage, she said.
Ursula seemed to have no fear of Nancy breaking, and held her tight.
You're going to have to help Teddy, she said urgently. Help him to cope with it.
Oh, Lord, Nancy thought wearily. Would none of them just let her be weak and irredeemably selfish? They stood on the platform waving as the train pulled out of the station, all of them in tears, Millie in floods. You would think I was going off to war, Nancy thought. The battle, however, was already fought and lost.
Plodding? She queried.
I know what you've been up to, he said.
In all these years she had never really seen Teddy angry, not like this, certainly, not with her. She went into the kitchen, walked over to the sink, turned the tap on, and filled a glass with water. She had rehearsed this moment on the train, an awful journey stuck in a carriage full of beery smokers leering at her. But when it came to it, she didn't seem to have the words. She drank the water slowly to give herself more time.
I know,
Teddy said, his voice tight with this new animosity. She turned to face him and said,
No, Teddy, you don't know. You don't know anything.
At first, the tumour had appeared to Nancy to be a predator, an invader, worming its way through the fibres in her brain, consuming her. But now it was settled. Now there were no more possibilities. It was no longer the enemy. It may not be a friend, far from it, but it was part of her. Hers and hers alone, and they would be companions to the awful end. She left work immediately. What, after all, would be the point of staying on, giving herself away to others? Viola, who was used to travelling to and from school with Nancy, was put out that suddenly she had to make her own way. Nancy taught her how to catch the bus.
But why?
Explaining that she wasn't very well, and needed to take some time away from teaching to get better. It was harsh for Viola that she was being thrust into an independence that she should have grown into slowly, but it had to be about practicalities now, not sentiment. The iron had entered into Nancy's soul. She bought clothes for Viola, 2 and 3 sizes ahead, made lists and notes, where her piano teacher lived, her friends' parents' addresses and phone numbers, her likes and dislikes. Teddy, of course, knew many of Viola's preferences, but even he could not have imagined the full range. She felt, ironically, remarkably well during the first few weeks that followed the confirmation of her death sentence. That was how she thought of it, although for everyone else's sake, there were euphemisms. She tidied drawers and cupboards, threw away unnecessary clutter, pared down her own wardrobe. Would she last through next winter? Would she need these drawers stuffed with woolens and vests and thick stockings? She imagined her sisters would come and sort through her clothes when she was gone, the way they had all done for their mother after the funeral. It would be a help to them if she broke the backbone of it now. She didn't discuss these rather macabre tasks with anyone. It would upset them more than it upset her, for Nancy drew considerable satisfaction from thinking that she was leaving things in good order. She imagined Gertie looking around her bedroom after she was gone, saying,
Good old Nancy. Typical of her to leave everything shipshape and Bristol fashion.
When it came to it, of course, Gertie said no such thing, too consumed by grief for such buoyant remarks. Teddy was confounded by all this energy and hazarded that somehow the diagnosis had been a mistake. Records get mixed up all the time. Or perhaps she was actually getting better.
That would be a miracle, Teddy, she said, as gently as she could. There is no cure.
Hope would be the worst thing for him. Her, too. She wanted to enjoy this respite for what it was, not for what it could never be.
But you thought I was dead during the war, he persisted. Did you give up hope?
Yes. Yes, I did. You know I did. And you said it yourself. I thought you were dead.
So then when I came back, it was a miracle, he said,
as if he'd won the argument. But he had come back from a POW camp, not from the dead. There was no logic in him these days. But then what did it really matter? He would stop believing in miracles soon enough. And then all the drawers were tidied. All the lists were made. When she stopped being busy, she discovered that she craved simply being on her own in the house, filling the silence with the piano, occasionally Beethoven, mostly Chopin. Her playing was rusty, but day by day she saw small improvements and said to Teddy,
"At least some things are capable of remedy."
But he shied away from gallows humour. One afternoon, when she was intent on the Polonaise in E-flat, fiendishly difficult, Teddy came home early, something he was doing more and more, she had noticed. She could feel him trying to fill his heart and mind with her, because that was where she would live on afterwards. Not living, just a memory, an illusion. And in her sister's hearts, too. And a little of her in Viola, and that would fade and be forgotten.
Our mother's favourite flower, of course, as you know.
My favourite flower is the bluebell,
she said, apropos of nothing to Viola one day, who said,
Oh?
Indifferently, more interested in watching Blue Peter. But then Teddy would die, her sisters would die, Viola would die, and nothing of Nancy would remain. That was how it was. The tragedy of life was death. Sic transit gloria mundi.
Penny for them,
Teddy said often, too often, when she was engaged in this philosophy, pointless by its very nature. Better to be a dumb animal like Bobby and greet every new morning in ignorance.
Oh, my thoughts are nonsense, she said, making an effort to smile at Teddy. You would feel cheated out of your penny.
It wasn't that she didn't want to share her thoughts with Teddy or spend time with him, and Viola, of course. But she was preparing to go into the darkness on her own, a place, not even a place, a nothing, where everything would cease to matter. Coco, library books, Chopin, love. That list, should she choose to make it, would be endless. She chose not to make it. She was done with lists. She put her morbid philosophy aside. She played Chopin instead. "Is that the Revolutionary?" Teddy asked, interrupting her concentration so that she played a wrong note that sounded particularly harsh to her ears.
"My mother used to play it," he said.
Sylvie had been a terrific pianist. Sometimes Nancy used to sneak next door to listen to her. When Sylvie was in a bad mood, you didn't need to go to Fox Corner to hear her, Nancy's father said. You could hear her from the end of the lane. He said this fondly.
There goes Mrs. Todd.
Major Shawcross held Sylvie in great esteem,
a magnificent creature.
It hadn't struck Nancy at the time, but perhaps Sylvie, too, had wanted to be left alone, had resented the quiet little listener in the corner of her drawing-room. She had seemed lost in the music, oblivious to Nancy's presence, until she finished whatever piece she was playing. Nancy couldn't help but applaud.
"Bravo, Mrs. Todd."
"Oh, it's you, Nancy," Sylvie would say, rather sharply.
"No, not the Revolutionary. It's the Heroic," Nancy said,
her hands resting impatiently on the keys. Time's winged chariot, she thought. She could hear the wings beating, heavy and creaking, like a great ponderous goose. She could feel her own strength ebbing away,
and was powerless to fight it.
"Your mother was accomplished," she said. "I'm a rank amateur, I'm afraid. And it's such a difficult piece."
"Sounded pretty good to me," Teddy said. He was lying, she knew.
"You reminded me of Vermeer, when I came into the room just now."
"Vermeer? Why?"
"That painting in the National Gallery. Lady at a virginal. Something like that, anyway."
"A young woman seated at a virginal," Nancy said.
"Yes. Your memory is always so precise."
"Why Vermeer?"
she prompted.
"It was the way you turned to look at me.
The enigmatic expression on your face."
"I always thought the girl in that picture had the look of a frog about her,"
Nancy said, thinking, "I look enigmatic because I'm dying."
"Isn't there one of a woman standing by a virginal, too?" he puzzled. "Or am I getting them mixed up?"
"No, there are two. The National has both."
"Same woman?"
Teddy said, looking ruminative.
"Same virginal?"
"Oh, do go away, my love," Nancy thought. "Stop spinning out conversations so that you'll have them to look back on. Stop making memories. Leave me to Chopin."
She sighed and closed the lid of the piano and said with forced cheerfulness,
"Shall we have some tea?"
"I'll make it,"
Teddy said eagerly.
"Would you like cake?
Do we have cake?"
"Yes, I believe we do."
"I want you to promise me something."
"Anything,"
Teddy said. A fatal promise to make, Nancy thought. They were sitting at the dining room table. Teddy was going through the month's bills, while Nancy was sewing Cash's name tapes onto Viola's uniform. The long school holiday was nearly over. The new school year was about to begin. The rhythm of Nancy's life had always been the school year, and it seemed strange that a new one was beginning that she wouldn't see the end of. "Viola B. Todd," the name tape said in that familiar red cursive. "B for Beresford, Teddy's middle name, Sylvie's name before she became a Todd. Her father had been an artist,
very famous in his day,
according to Sylvie, although the family owned none of his work. Nancy had been delighted when, investigating the art gallery in York with Viola, she had found a portrait, some civic dignitary, long forgotten now, painted by Sylvie's father at the end of the last century. The tiny brass plaque beneath read, "Llewellyn A. Beresford, 1845-1903, and a ghostly monogram of the letters L, A and B was painted in the corner of the picture.
"Look," Nancy said to Viola, "this was painted by your great-grandfather."
But it was a relationship too distant to have any meaning for Viola. Nancy began a new name tape on the collar of a school blouse, and almost immediately pricked herself with the needle. She was a clumsy seamstress these days, and she could no longer follow a knitting pattern. She imagined the silent bees were secretly making a honeycomb in her brain.
"Are you all right?"
Teddy asked, looking at the perfect little sphere of blood on her finger. She nodded and licked the drop away before it could stain the blouse.
"Promise me,"
she continued, laying her sewing down,
"that when the time comes..."
Teddy flinched at the phrase.
"When the time comes, you will help me."
"Help you what?"
He abandoned the gas bill he had been checking. He knew perfectly well what.
"Help me to go. When it starts to get bad. If I can't help myself." "And it will get bad, Teddy."
"It might not."
She could scream with frustration at the avoidance, the ducking and diving. She was dying of brain cancer. It was going to be brutal, savage, completely bad. Unless she was outrageously fortunate, she was not going to fade away in serene sleep.
"But if it does start to get bad,"
she said patiently,
"then I want to go before I become a drooling imbecile.
I want to die as myself," she thought.
"You wouldn't let a dog suffer, so please don't let me."
"You want me to put you down, like a dog?"
he said testily.
"That's not what I said," You know it isn't. But you want me to kill you?
No. To help me kill myself.
And that's better in what way?
Nancy pushed on.
Only if it's difficult for me to do because I become incapacitated.
Morphine or tablets, something like that. I'm not sure.
Or just stick a pillow over my face, for heaven's sake, and be done with it, she thought. But of course that would never do.
It must clearly be by my own hand, she said. Otherwise you'll be tried for murder.
Now there was a barbarous word to lay before him.
But it's as good as, he said. I don't really see the difference.
His hands were clasped together, and he stared at them as if assessing whether or not they could do the deed. After a considerable silence, he said,
I'm not sure I can.
Not looking at her, looking anywhere but at her, anguish on his face. You made the fatal promise, Nancy thought. You promised anything. You made another promise, too, she thought, for better or worse. And now we've come to worse. The worst. And a mean thought. How many had he killed during the war?
Never mind, she said,
reaching across the table and putting forgiving hands on top of his, clenched now in a kind of rigour.
It might not get bad after all. We'll just have to see.
He nodded gratefully, as if she'd given him benediction. He was a terrible coward. He had rained down destruction on thousands, on women and children, no different from his wife, his child, his mother, his sister. He had killed people from 20,000 feet up in the sky, but to kill one person who was asking to die. He had watched as the life went out of Keith. He didn't know if he could do that again, even for Nancy. He had known her since he was 3 years old, childhood sweethearts, all of his conscious remembering life. And he was to be her executioner? He had imagined them settling into an unchallenging old age. He couldn't picture himself, but he could see Nancy growing thick in the waist, acquiring comfortable chins and grey hair, a little like Mrs. Shawcross. She would strain her eyes to knit and to do the telegraph crossword. He would dig up potatoes, she would pull up weeds. She was not a gardener, but she couldn't be idle. They would be good companions, and they would fade quietly away together. And now she was just going to leave early. He remembered Sylvie's displeasure at Hugh's sudden, easy death.
He just slipped away without a word.
To cease upon the midnight with no pain, Teddy thought. Didn't Nancy deserve that? She would have to seek her own solace, she realized. She was lying on Viola's bed. Viola asleep in the crook of her arm. Nancy was uncomfortable. It was still a small child's bed. Viola would need a bigger one soon, but it wouldn't be Nancy who bought it. She had been reading Anne of Green Gables to Viola. Anne, too, had had to acquire iron in her soul. Sometimes, if she wasn't too sleepy at bedtime, Viola read to Nancy instead. Viola was a good reader, a bookworm, a phrase she hated.
How can a worm be a nice thing to be?
Viola said. I would be a worm, Nancy thought, if that was the only existence on offer, and then laughed at herself for having reached such a pass.
Without worms, we wouldn't be able to grow food, and everyone would starve,
Nancy said reasonably. She must make sure that Teddy knew she wanted to be cremated, to go up in flames, a pyre, and be returned to the atomic world of elements. It would be better for Viola not to spend the rest of her childhood imagining her mother buried in the dark, damp earth, worms feeding on her flesh. Nancy's heart was heavier every day. To be thinking of such things, to feel obliged to think of such things, while lying with one's arms around one's child, Anne of Green Gables open on the bedspread, Viola's glass of milk, half-drunk on the bedside table, cocoa, library books, and so on. In the past few weeks, they had also read together The Secret Garden and Heidi. No coincidence that they were all tales about orphans. After Anne, if there was time, Nancy planned to move on to Little Women. Not orphans, it was true, but strong, resourceful young women. All the Shawcross sisters had loved Louisa May Alcott.
And fairy tales, too, she said to Winnie, who had popped up for a quick weekend visit.
Winnie, the eldest of them all, lived in Kent. She had married well to a self-styled captain of industry, a title that amused her sisters. But she was a good sort, kind-hearted and competent.
"Think about all those heroines who have to be quick-witted just to survive," Nancy said. "Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, Snow White. People have the wrong idea about fairy tales. They think they're about being rescued by handsome princes, whereas really they're like Girl Guide handbooks."
"Beauty and the Beast," Winnie offered, warming to the subject. They were having tea, and Winnie was slicing up a cherry Genoa she had brought with her. No one expected Nancy to bake any more, which was as well, as she could barely lift a kettle. Teddy came home every evening and cooked and did housework. Nancy was never hungry any more, always tired. She used to be up with the lark, but now Teddy brought her tea in bed every morning, and she lay there for hours after Teddy and Viola had left the house to get on with their lives.
"You look so well there," Winnie said.
"I have headaches," Nancy said, feeling rather defensive.
She was tired of people telling her how well she looked, as if she were cheating somehow. Of course, Winnie didn't mean it like that, she chided herself.
"The Goose Girl," Winnie said. "Did she have a name? I can only remember the horse's name."
"Falada.
A funny name for a horse. But I don't know about the Goose Girl herself. Nameless, I think."
"Shall I be mother and paw?" Winnie said. Even the simplest of sentences could be like a dagger to Nancy's heart.
"Please."
Would this be the last time that she ever saw her eldest sister, she wondered? Soon, now even, it would become a cascade of last times. It was imperative that she go quickly, early, sidestepping the awfulness of all the farewells. She could throw herself beneath the wheels of an express train, but then think of the poor driver. Could she walk into the sea or cast herself into a river? But by instinct she might swim.
"The girl with the brothers who were turned into swans," Winnie said. "What was she called? She was very brave."
"She was. Elise. The Wild Swans."
What about Poison? Too horrible, Nancy thought, too uncertain. She might gag on it rather than swallow it.
"Hansel and Gretel," Winnie said. "But just Gretel, really. Hansel wasn't too bright, was he?"
"No. He got himself locked up."
Sisters are always cleverer than their brothers in fairy stories. Hanging was supposed to be quick, but deeply distressing for whoever found you, which might well be, probably would be, either Teddy or, unthinkable, Viola.
"Goldilocks," Winnie said. "Was she foolish rather than enterprising?"
"Foolish, I think," Nancy said. "She had to be rescued."
She was going to have to rescue herself. She must start a cache, sleeping tablets and painkillers, anything she could get her hands on. She must take them while she was still capable, still in control. It was difficult to assess what would constitute a fatal dose. It wasn't the kind of thing you could ask, although she had a different GP now, a Dr. Webster, who was the older, wiser partner of the GP she had first seen.
"A young buck," Dr. Webster called him.
Thankfully, Dr. Webster was happy to talk about the reality of what was to come. But what if she had left it too late? Was it already too late?
"Gerda, in the Snow Queen," she said to Winnie. "She was very resourceful."
The Fourier series, theorems, lemmas, graphs, Parseval's theorem, natural numbers, words hummed in her brain. She had understood them all once, but now their meaning was lost to her. The bees were back, an endless, infuriating buzzing that she tried to drown out with the piano. She had played nothing but the heroic all day. It was incredibly challenging, but she was determined to master it. She was playing with great vigour, con brio. It sounded almost perfect to her ears. How extraordinary, how wonderful that she had become so proficient at such a difficult piece. It was as if this, and this only, had been her life's work. She finished with an enormous flourish.
"Hello, you," Teddy said, coming into the room. "Fancy a cup of tea?"
He was carrying a tray, Viola trotting at his heels.
"Shall I help you into an armchair?"
He was fussing. He put the tray down and led her to a chair by the window.
"You like this one, don't you?" he said. "You can see the birds on the bird table."
She wished he wouldn't stare at her like that, as if he was trying to see something behind her eyes. He settled her feet on a footstool, a tea on a table by the side of her. Tea in a beaker. Cups and saucers had suddenly become fiddly, confusing.
"Do you want a biscuit, Mummy?"
Viola was hovering at her elbow.
"Chocolate bourbon, or pink wafers." "Or there's some of Wynne's cake left," Teddy said. "It goes on without end.
It would have done better than the loaves and fishes for feeding the 5,000. Nancy ignored both offers. She was feeling rather annoyed that neither of them had congratulated her on her magnificent playing.
"Bravo, Mrs. Todd!"
Yet her triumph with the Chopin was fading already. The bees were making her sleepy. All that buzzing. Honey was oozing through her brain. Time folded in on itself. Where had Teddy gone? Wasn't he here a minute ago? It felt as if everyone had just left the room. Or perhaps it was Nancy herself who had left the room. But there was no room. There was only something she didn't have a name for. Nothing. And then there wasn't even that. And then the bees took flight and blessed her in farewell, and Nancy stopped. Dead.
"A stiff whiskey, that's my prescription. Pour one for me, too."
Their GP, Dr. Webster, who was looking forward to retirement, a bit of golf, some watercolour painting. He was the old-fashioned sort. He had given his blessing to Nancy when she refused the operation, and had been generous with the morphine and held back on homilies. A crisp October morning. Spiderwebs were spangled across the plants in the garden. It was going to be a beautiful day. Bobby, their Labrador, paced between the rooms, confused by the upset in his regime. Routine was the first thing to be discarded by a death. Teddy poured the whiskey and handed one to the doctor. He raised his glass, and for an odd, rather awful moment, Teddy thought he was going to say cheers. But instead he said,
"Let us toast, Nancy."
And it was still odd and rather awful, but made sense somehow. And Teddy raised his glass and said,
"To Nancy. From this world to that which is to come,"
Dr. Webster said, surprising Teddy with Pilgrim's Progress.
"She was a good woman, such a bright mind, and a kind nature."
Teddy downed the whiskey in one. He wasn't ready for eulogies.
"You should call the police," he said. "Now why on earth would I do that?"
"Because I killed her," Teddy said.
"You helped her on her way with a little extra dose of morphine. If that was a crime, I would be serving several life sentences."
"I killed her," Teddy said stubbornly.
"Now listen to me. She was a few hours away from death."
The GP looked alarmed, Teddy noticed. It was him, after all, who had been so generous with his liquid morphine prescriptions over the last few weeks for her awful headaches.
"Nancy was in distress,"
the doctor continued.
"You did the right thing."
He had visited Nancy the previous evening and given his opinion that it
wouldn't be long now,
and added,
"Do you have enough morphine?"
"Enough," Teddy thought. He had been in the kitchen making a shepherd's pie, when he heard the terrible cacophony coming from the living room. Before he could run through to investigate, a tearful Viola appeared in the kitchen and said,
"There's something wrong with Mummy."
Nancy was bashing at the piano keys, as if she was trying to destroy the instrument. Her hands were clawed almost into fists, and when he had taken hold of them in an effort to quieten her, she had looked at him with a strange, lopsided smile on her face, and tried to form words. It seemed important to her that he understood, but it was Viola standing beside him that translated her spastic mumble.
"The heroic," she said.
He led her gently into an armchair by the window, and they ministered to her with tea and biscuits. But when he looked into her eyes, he knew that the thing she had feared the most had happened to her. Nancy was no longer Nancy. He had helped her to bed early, but she had woken before midnight, moaning and calling out. Whether from pain or distress, he couldn't tell. Both, he supposed. The shell, the shade of the woman who had once been his wife, was shouting out nonsense, not even words, just barks and growls like an animal. He made warm milk, put in a tot of rum, and emptied several of the morphine vials into it. Then he sat Nancy up and wrapped a bed jacket around her thin shoulders.
"Drink up," he said, excessively cheerful. "This will make you feel much better."
He didn't spot Viola, woken by the inhuman noises her mother was making, standing sleepily in the doorway of the bedroom, in bare feet and cotton pajamas. Instead of falling into the deep sleep that Teddy had hoped would be the precursor of death, Nancy grew suddenly much more agitated, throwing herself around in the bed, tearing at the bedspread, her nightdress, her hair, as if she was trying to rid herself of a burning demon. He added more morphine to the milk that remained in the beaker, but her thrashing arm sent it flying across the room. She started screaming, an unholy noise, unstoppable, her wide-open mouth a black maw, as if she finally had become the demon that was in her brain. In desperation, Teddy grabbed a pillow and pressed it against her face, at first tentatively and then more firmly, unable to bear the idea that at the end, the very end, she should be denied peace. Denied the ceasing upon the midnight with no pain. He pressed down hard on the pillow. This is what it meant to kill someone. Hand-to-hand combat. Until death us do part. She was still. He removed the pillow. The fight was out of her. Or perhaps the morphine had worked. But she lay still. He felt her pulse. Stopped. His own heart was thundering. Her face was peaceful. The pain and animal distress had fallen away. She was Nancy again. She was herself. Viola padded silently back to bed. The true nightmares occur when we are awake, according to the narrator of Every Third Thought, her last novel. Her best yet. Good housekeeping.
"And what would happen to that little girl upstairs if you were arrested and stood trial?"
Dr. Webster said. She had any number of aunts she could live with, Teddy thought. Any one of them would probably do a better job than he would.
"If something happens to you as well,"
Nancy had said to him,
"then I think Viola should go and live with Gertie. Not that anything is going to happen to you, of course."
Out of all the aunts available, Gertie seemed almost the oddest choice, Milly taking first place in the race for unsuitability.
"Why Gertie?"
he asked.
"She's sensible, and practical, and patient," Nancy said,
ticking off Gertie's virtues on her fingers.
"But at the same time she's adventurous, and not frightened by things. She'll be able to teach Viola how to be brave."
Viola wasn't brave, they both knew that, but neither of them ever said it. What right did Teddy have to talk about bravery, he thought, pouring both himself and Dr. Webster another whiskey?
"I'll make out the death certificate,"
the GP said.
You should probably telephone an undertaker, or I'll do it for you if you prefer.
No, Teddy said. I'll do it.
After the doctor had left, Teddy went upstairs to Viola's room. She was still fast asleep.